Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini, literary producer for Spokane Public Radio. Today, we're bringing you a special episode in advance of Spokane's annual literary festival, Get Lit, which begins next week. This year, Get Lit is celebrating its 20th anniversary. The festival started in 1998 with a single day of literary readings hosted by Eastern Washington University Press and EWU's Department of Creative Writing. Since then, the festival has continued to grow, attracting thousands of readers and writers to Spokane, featuring keynote authors such as Kurt Vonnegut, David Sedaris, Jane Smiley, Salman Rushdie, Rita Dove, and Richard Russo, as well as regional favorites like Jess Walter, Tobias Wolff, Tess Gallagher, and Timothy Egan. This year's festival includes a full week of readings, workshops, poetry slams, classes, panel discussions, children's events, and more, Monday, April 23rd through Sunday the 29th. Headlining authors this year are novelist Britt Bennett, poet Maggie Smith, and best-selling fiction and nonfiction writer Anne Lamott. In addition to the big-name authors and keynote events, every year the Get Lit Festival also features dozens of writers from Spokane's thriving literary scene. In this episode of The Bookshelf, we'll hear from four of those authors, reading their own work and giving you a taste of the upcoming events at Get Lit. If you like what you hear, you can find the full festival schedule at getlitfestival.org.
My name is Catherine Smith. I will be participating in a panel at Get Lit on Friday at Spokane Falls Community College, and I will be reading on Sunday at the alumni reading. I'm going to share some poems from my new book, which is called Book of Exodus. The poem is set in a wilderness that's completely set apart from society, and the poems are about a family who lives there, about wilderness and isolation and scarcity. And for the family that inhabits these poems, their fears and desires are often manifested in dreams, as they are for many of us. So these are some dream poems from Book of Exodus. The girl who has never seen a city dreams a city. Papa laughed when I described it. Not everyone is the same, dear child. The buildings do not cut the sky in one straight and perfect line. The roofs angle, like they are trying to explain. Each house an arrow that knows it can never reach the heavens to which it eternally points. She dreams of heaven's bounty. I sat down with the Lord but could not see his whole face. At the table I was given no portion. I saw only his mouth as the Lord raised bread to his lips, then meat, his teeth tearing flesh from the leg of an animal, juices dripping from his fingers to the floor. I thought the watching could feed me. I peeled fig after fig with my eyes until the Lord said my name, Agafia, crouch and eat. Beneath the table, his feet, his sandals, and the sumptuous crumbs, the everlasting. She dreams salvation. In the year of the great famine, I dreamed one rye sprout survived the June frosts, breaking through a crust of pea shoots, limp and blackened with cold. It unfurled skyward, a visible rising toward brilliant spring light. Waking, I prayed my dream true. I built a fence to keep the creatures out. It was still dark. I could not see what I was protecting. Her sister dreams of luxury. A room to myself. A pump to draw the water directly indoors. A new dress in bright colors, its collar chafing. A goose down mattress brimming with quilts. A mule to draw the plow. Flowers, the taste of sweetness, to be scrubbed clean, shovel, salt, someone to place his hand on the back of my neck and lift the weight of my hair. She dreams her own undoing. I had shoes. Shoes, the taut pull of laces to keep me upright, soles a holy barrier between body and earth. My sister had none, so I shared them, one shoe at a time. To give both would be to let comfort seduce her. She would never give them back. Both of us then feared the leather's ruin. So the rabbits came, gnawing pea shoots to the root. The hearts nosed out the last heads of lettuce. Cucumber dribbled from a cub's silky chin. He stretched a paw toward me in vegetal offering, but my feet were fixed. One shod on the safety of firmer ground, one bare and sinking at the edge of the plot. Dream without end. And when I entered that dream, I stayed there, in the realm of new civilization. Beasts roamed the broken streets. My one desire was to save the fledglings that fell from nests abandoned by their mothers. Even when I woke, I stayed there, tending wounded animals who trip on fractured paths. My instinct is folly, and there is no way out, for dreaming is its own wilderness. Once I have crossed the threshold, it disappears. The sky brightens, then closes me in.
That was Catherine Smith, reading poems from her new collection, Book of Exodus. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode features readings from authors who are all participating in this year's Get Lit Festival, which takes place April 23rd through 29th at locations around Spokane.
I'm Bruce Hulbert. I'm a local writer here in the Spokane area. I'm going to be reading the alumni reading, Get Lit, and be hopefully attending several other of the events there. This is from my most recent book, Whiskey. Andre is a teacher who doesn't think too much of himself and hasn't had much luck in love, and he's encounters a woman who he finds attractive but doesn't have the wherewithal to figure out how to approach her. Faculty meetings, Andre tarried until Claire entered the room and then hunted a seat behind him or across from her. Making notes, she employed a pencil but didn't erase, instead slashed her words and scribbled on. She whispered as she perused handouts, a habit calming to reading teachers. Her high cheekbones and narrow jaw pinched her mouth in a pretty way when she spoke, and her nose remained out of matters, which was the best that could be said of any nose. Her chestnut hair was cut to her shoulders. It curled when she rose early enough to use an iron and lay straight when she did not. She was appealing either way. Andre longed to say so and save her the trouble. Nights, when he climbed far enough into the bag, Andre would press his hands together as if in prayer, then undo them until his palms separated, and he could conjure her face between. He had encountered prettier women, but none that made him ache so clearly for a life other than his own. After the time change, the evenings grayed early, and from a quarter mile behind, distance enough to argue denial or coincidence, Andre began to trail Claire to her duplex, two hills behind the school. She marked themes while she hiked the incline, chewing a red pencil between notes, and didn't divert her attention even while she unlocked her door. Soon, despite cold winds or spitting snow, Andre lingered in an alley's shadows where he could view Claire's front window. Evening, she often halted before the glass to gaze at passing cars or her neighbors exercising their terrier. She typically changed to a t-shirt and sweatpants. Her hands clawed her hair like she'd had a nap or been stirred from a book. Seeing her embarrassed him, and he pitched his eyes away down the hill where the house roofs below collided geometries. A month into his vigil, he unwrapped a meatloaf sandwich for his dinner and ate, comfortable, until Claire gully-whomped him from behind with a 2-foot icicle. His stunned skull sang like a tuning fork as Claire's soap smell passed, so simple it seemed impossible. He lay bleeding until the police tumblers approached. A cop's flashlight wand striped the dumpster where he'd taken refuge. Andre stood and hoisted his hands. "What are you surrendering over?" the cop asked. His name was Marcus Pop, and he was 2 years behind Andre in high school. Answering to him seemed one more injustice. "You decide," Andre said. The cop wagged his light at Andre's cleft scalp. "You know the woman in that building?" "Yes." "You gonna fight me?" the cop asked. A minor tavern legend to regulars, in a scrap Andre accepted blows without regard and offered his own until he grew too tired to lift his hand. Recently, he'd pinned an ironworker's ears to his skull with a stapler. While the man attempted to claw the staples out, Andre splattered his nose and uprooted his front teeth with the handle. The Honyaker was new to town. No one local or sober had tried Andre for years. "I'm not inclined to fight," Andre said. "Okay," the cop replied. By then, Claire had pulled open the door. Oily light from inside spread across the snow-blanched yard. She proceeded in slippers toward them. "You," she said. Andre nodded. "You deserve to be hit." "I know it." The cop didn't move. He was enjoying himself. Claire's brow creased and she blinked. The blood bank took a pint, and Andre guessed he'd leaked nothing less. It warmed his cheek but froze in his hair. "I did that?" Andre shrugged. "Head wound," he said. "They always bleed worse than they are." The cop signed Andre in at the hospital emergency desk, then suggested he review his manners. He saw no one to cuff him or offer him Miranda. Andre had not even made a successful crime of it, which demoralized him even further. Despite much study, Andre had not acquired the element most necessary for romance in this world, the capacity to appear detached in a tragic and compelling manner that presses a woman to discover why. Instead, woman saw Andre as plain country, a flat lot on a town road like any other. An abundance of heart and a scarcity of self-regard served him poorly, but a man suffering such who hadn't swallowed a gun barrel was likely not just dirt and rock and scrub. An hour later, the doctor knit Andre's eyebrow with 15 stitches, then sheared half his scalp so he could add 20 more. Andre listened to the scissors snip and contemplated the 4 miles home. He could phone Smoker, but only after assembling a tale that justified his injuries. He narrowed the possibilities to brawling Californians or a slow-moving 4x4 on the icy streets by the time the hospital released him and he found the exit. Local urchins had shot out the parking lot lights with pellet guns, so Andre didn't recognize Claire's approach until she was too close for escape. "Should I be flattered?" she asked him. "Or were you just in it for an eyeful?" "I hope you're not armed," Andre replied. She reversed her jeans to demonstrate she was no danger, but there was still the jacket, so Andre steadied his feet and loped for town. 20 yards and the frozen sidewalk spilled him to all fours. Claire's hand hooked his elbow and steered him up. "I'll see you home," she said. In her car, Andre pointed toward the trailer court, but Claire traveled another direction and parked at a stop-and-go. Inside, she bought tall coffees, which left Andre the prospect of bearing his embarrassment, both awake and sober. Claire dipped her face into her cup while Andre waited for the cream to cool his own. "Our first date," she said. "This isn't a date," Andre told her. "Why not?" "Because if it was, I'd be worried about getting kissed at the end." Claire arched her eyebrow, then bent across the emergency brake. Their lips clobbered bluntly, and Andre lost a good share of his coffee in his lap. Scalded, he gasped, and his legs straightened, which scuffed his scalp against the roof. He put his hand to the wounds, but the stitches seemed to hold. Claire retreated to her seat. She tipped herself over the steering wheel, and her hands latched her knees. A long hair clung to her ring finger, the other end twisted in the heater's exhaust. Light through the window flickered in the strand. Andre extended his fingers to touch it. Claire hurried her hand away, then changed horses and plucked it into his. "I'm sorry," Andre said. I'm not accustomed." "Me neither," Claire told him. "Please don't think I am." Claire fit a straw through her coffee top. The radio played a commercial, though Andre couldn't make out what for. "I never saw you naked," he said. Claire gazed out the windshield. The market lights made the snow more starry than the sky. "I went home early, before 8 always." "You scared me is all." Claire joined their hands and stroked a finger on his split hairline. He winced. "I used to pinch my brothers until they'd bleed," she said quietly. "I guess I have a mean streak." He returned her hand to the shifter ball. Her fingers tapped the enamel. He wanted them to doctor him. "You spied on me in school," she said. "I guess I'm none too sly, am I? Someone else pointed it out to me. Stack." Stack Edwards was in charge of PE and wore T-shirts even in winter. Andre hadn't seen them as much as sit together. Claire took Andre's hand in hers, then raised them both. He didn't like public displays of affection. Their coffee depleted, Andre excused himself to refill the cups. A Williams girl tended the till. She had a gabby bent, and the line went 3 deep. A piece of him knew Claire would be in the warm car when he returned, and it would be as if he'd never left her, while another remained certain she would be absent, and whatever had happened between them had not.
That was author Bruce Holbert reading from his new novel, Whiskey. Bruce is one of many local authors you can expect at this year's Get Lit Literary Festival in Spokane, April 23rd through 29th. Next, we'll hear from poet Maya Jewel Zeller. You can catch Maya at the small press reading on Saturday afternoon during Get Lit. Here's Maya reading from her latest collection, Alchemy for Cells and Other Beasts.
The doctor asks her to describe it. Our hollowed brains bump along these halls like buoys, or like deer lain down by a tree when the day's last light folds to a crease. It's spring, so antlers are soft like velvet, easily broken like skin, easily sanctioned by men who need healing, whose bodies want to be held by other bodies. I've read what can be done with their head bones, a whole village healed and more babies. I am only part monster. Part of me is a woman, a home for your disease, or what you imagine disease to be, a window you fear too much to pull open. I have grown to fear the glass too, and what lies beyond, even the dark forest, where before this, trees seemed kelp-like in the breeze. It wasn't so different, a leaf riding wind currents, taking its time, insects or lichen, moss or its tiny spores that resembled plankton or a human reproductive organ. Look, by now, I've learned how I sound. It's like your boat crashed on this island. I'm the only option to keep you from floating away alone. Little spell with a ship on its back. You rode in on. Little spell misspelled on the paper, on shore. Little spell migration error. Little spell, you wear ribbon and sailor suit and you left your language across the ocean. Little spell on cobbled streets. Little spell a history of pleated skirts. The book held open in your hand, remembering its promises. Little spell of learning another story. Little spell of cutting off your hair. Little spell of a new watershed. Little spell of shifting earth. Of wanting the salt closer in proximity to your spine. Of learning to sail. Little spell your shoes back on land. So you crack a fist into the sternum of sky, like a stone woman on an island. Who is this woman you can't scrub from your dreams? Cell matter, the math of your being. something you'll hand like a board to a child with whom you may or may not share a coding. When I say heart, I mean in the heart of a dark forest. In photographs, the human heart can resemble a lightning-wrapped fruit, or something your mother might cook, your father eat, while trees sketch their final streaks in the late light, and you whisper some dull news of family through the telephone, who is pregnant again, and who needs to drink less, and who filed for divorce. If you knew very little, you might mistake the small heart of a fawn for that of a girl, the way the hunter hoped the queen would when he brought her that still warm bundle from the wood where he let Snow White wander, stumbling, into briars and the thick black howls of wolves. Once it is believed you are dead already, you can overcome all kinds of curses. You might walk right into a magic house where small men care for you and you for them for years until foolishly you eat the same treat Eve, that witch, touched to Adam's lips so he would fall upon the sleep of knowledge, that stupor we all crumble helplessly into when we are old enough to listen to adults and mirrors and the rustle of a reptile or a foot on the trail. My mother tells me of my brother's congestive heart failure, stage C, how his legs swell and he sleeps sitting up in his chair, his six children sneaking past like elves while he snores. Oh, bright apple, thumping metaphor, poison darling, you climb into my ruby throat. It's been so long since you thought I really cared, cruel sister, civil girl, ink still. In the tale, sometimes the mirror breaks at the queen's rage, and she storms into the forest, and the dead girl wakes to bluebirds and a warm breakfast, unaware that just beyond the bramble, pulsing like ventricles, a dark cloaked woman she once called mother paces the morning, races toward her future, a blade of glass in her hand.
That was Maya Jewel Zeller, reading poems from her collection Alchemy for Cells and Other Beasts. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode, we're featuring local authors participating in next week's Get Lit Literary Festival, alongside headlining authors Britt Bennett, Maggie Smith, and Anne Lamott. You can find the full festival schedule and more information about all the authors we're featuring in this episode of The Bookshelf at getlitfestival.org.
My name is Brooke Mattson, and I'm a poet and the executive director of Spark Central. And I am going to be reading at Get Lit's Spokane Literary Community Panel on Monday. On Tuesday, I'll be reading at Starstruck at Spark Central. And on Thursday, I'll be reading at Pie and Whiskey. Dust Devil. Devil, because it lived in the desert alone, because it dwelled in spin and form and body, then kicked off a rock and vanished, the dirt collapsing like abandoned clothes, like when a song ends and loneliness blisters where the melody burned. Naming a thing makes it so. My sister and I listened to every pocket rocker mixtape in the back seat, miming lyrics we didn't understand, the car dragging like a match across the August interstate, the slow scrape of a family road trip. We were that bored, naming things that had names already, naming the steel transformer towers Giant Marcy, because if you squinted, they looked like the life-sized paper cutout I made of myself in kindergarten. The day I brought it home, my sister named it Giant Marcy because it seemed bigger than me, even though my body, spread eagle on the classroom floor, gave it form. Her crayoned face was more lurid than mine. She looked like a Marcy. She looked powerful, a massive chrome shape duplicating across the horizon. So many arms the clouds couldn't escape. The dust devil followed us too, but it wasn't a devil, Mom said, only wind. It seemed determined to me, hot little ghost. Each time we drove close, it danced away like a snake, and once it ran straight at the hood of our car and opened like a flower of dust. We drove right through where it flung out its arms. At the planetarium, I cursed the Ken Burns effect. Like Matthew McConaughey in Interstellar, I want to enter the lip of the event horizon. You have to lose hard to get that hungry. A gambler who's folded his life to the house. Patrick Stewart's voice fills the ceiling with stars. He backs us away from a black hole, blocks my desire to dive in. I want it to be like those dreams where you fly by thinking, can press voraciously toward the sky, the need to go where no you has gone before, burning like a supermassive sun. I have those dreams every few months and try so hard to stay lucid, to become like the gods strewn across the ceiling in their broken rosaries of light. I get too involved. I forget who I am. We wheel around a nebula, a quasar, pan close to questions, then veer away, the Ken Burns effect. Forward, I want to yell into the dome of night, at the dealer who shuffles the cards, the narrator who insists on withholding for the sequel. When I ask where the best seat in the house is, the astronomer looks at me hard before saying, everywhere.
That was Brooke Mattson. Brooke will be participating in the Get Lit Literary Festival, April 23rd through 29th, at various venues around Spokane. You can find the full festival schedule, along with more information about all the authors featured in this episode, online at getlitfestival.org. Get Lit is housed within Eastern Washington University's College of Arts, Letters, and Education. They, along with community sponsors and partners like Gonzaga University, Community Colleges of Spokane, North Idaho College, and Whitworth University, put on the Get Lit Festival each April. You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. Music in this episode was by Blanket Music. Executive producer for The Bookshelf is Vern Windham. And I'm Chris Messini.